Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 17th. It was years in the making. FESPAC 2024 delayed by the pandemic. Well, it just wrapped up yesterday, and our Pacific Island brothers and sisters are returning home. We take a closer look at some highlights. And we hear from Niatero, a group that aims at connecting Native peoples across the globe, not just across the Pacific. It was a thoughtful conversation about empowerment and healing our earth, our water, our land. We learn about the motion of circles in art and where you can see some wondrous creations from a Japanese master of silk. And Marcus Mariota is just coming off of summer team practices. We catch up with the former St. Louis Crusader, former Duck, and current Commander. FESPAC 2024 drew to a close last night, and the displays at the Hawaii Convention Center began coming down Saturday. Many of our Pacific brothers and sisters began the long journey back to their home islands, and some left early because of limited flight schedules. HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio has been covering the festival from start to finish and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Oh, gosh. What an event that was. It was remarkable.
Yeah. I'm fest-packed out already.
Yes.
But this really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, especially in our lifetime, for Hawaii to host FESPAC and have all of these Pacific Islanders from across Oceania come together in one space. And what I've learned from the festival is many Pacific Islanders, whether they're from the diaspora or from their home countries, they really thought of this festival as is coming together and bridging connections. And those in the diaspora, I think Aaron Salah from the closing ceremony last night said it best, that this festival is dedicated to Pacific Islanders in the diaspora to build and bridge those connections. And this festival meant a lot for Taufa Setefano. She is a Tongan woman from California, and this was her first time attending the festival.
I think being Tonga in the diaspora, you're not Tonga enough in Tonga. And then when you're in the Western society, you're not American enough. So it's a dynamic that questions your belonging. And I feel like FESPAC has allowed that bridge to be made because your country is showing up to where you're at. And I understand there's a lot of complexities, but to be able to be present in a festival like this has allowed me to see people from my country that I don't know, and I look forward to learning from them, and they're straight from the islands. So it allows me to have a sense of belonging and connection in seeing myself. Like, I do have roots in this land, and they're living and they're thriving, and I can talk to them and they're here. So it's been beautiful.
Yeah, so it really is. It's a sense of pride and cultural identity.
It certainly is. And what's interesting about FESPAC, we know it was created in 1972, and it was because a group of elders from the South Pacific, mostly in the Melanesia region, wanted to halt the erosion of Pacific culture. We're now that, and during that time, that was like a post-colonial era where a lot of Western foreigners and powers actually came and colonized most of the Pacific, except for Tonga. That was actually new to me, that Tonga, the Kingdom of Tonga, was never really fully colonized, so they were able to preserve their indigenous governance, which they never lost. So that was really interesting to me. But they, the group of elders wanted to halt the erosion of culture through cultural exchange. And we know this festival is held every 4 years, rotating throughout Polynesia, Micronesia, and Melanesia. And we know Hawaii was supposed to host the festival in 2020, but due to the COVID-19 pandemic, that was postponed. So technically, the state had 8 years to plan. And I know there's been a lot of logistic issues. For example, some flights were delayed for the delegates getting here. And I know the festival planners put a cap for each of the 26 Pacific nations, only 100 delegates per nation. But Aaron Salah said it best at the closing ceremony that actually some of the delegates exceeded that. Some exceeded up to 230 people. So even though I've heard some delegates said that they were still hungry when they were staying at the dorms because there wasn't enough food supply, but the festival still came together and was done beautifully. But something about this festival was like no other, and that was according to Letila Mitchell of the South Pacific Commission. That commission was the one who created the festival in 1972. Although the festival is to share culture and arts, there's definitely more dialogue this FestPAC.
Those of us who are fortunate to come here, when such difficulties happen, we reflect back on our homes. What do you do when somebody is in mourning or is celebrating? We have to go and be part of them to share their difficulties, and then we offer opportunities for us to be able to work together. We must be able to have a mechanism for reconciliation, and in our tradition we have that. So when we come here, when Vanuatu is not here, or especially the Kanaki people, it does give us a little bit of challenge that we feel sort of slightly disheartened, but all the same, it gives us the opportunity to show support, and the solidarity from the rest of the Pacific Island, it is so important. And I can hear from the floor today, yes, we must continue to go from strength to strength. So this festival opens up a lot of avenues so that we are able to look forward as times are changing, yes. I have seen that, and I would like to see us change with a positive attitude.
That was actually Henry Issa. He's a 74-year-old elder from the Solomon Islands. I got to talk to him actually on Thursday, and this actually is about his eighth FestPAC. So he really got to see the difference of how the festival evolved. And even though we're now post-COVID, he said the challenges that they were experiencing before is still prevalent now. For example, in Pacific culture, how me and you are talking, we exchange oral storytelling. But he's saying that some of the younger generations is more in tune with their phones. Sometimes they're not getting most of the traditions through oral storytelling. But I spoke with also James Bamba, Chamorro Weaver from the CNMI, or the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands in Micronesia. He actually used social media to his advantage to actually gravitate more of the younger Pacific Islander generations to learn our cultures, such as weaving, for example. But Letila was the one who said that there was more dialogue in this festival.
One thing that's very noticeable, you know, in the last few years, and, you know, particularly that you see at this festival, is the strength of young leadership and, you know, very strong young Indigenous voices. So a lot of the countries are really sort of uplifting their young people, and that because they're going to be the change makers, or they're already those change makers. And, you know, and all of the countries in, you know, have spoken a lot about what it means for the Pacific in the future, as we have nations that are, you know, being threatened by climate change. And so, you know, there is definitely a lot of discussion about how we make sure that the Indigenous voices and the people who will be affected by these things, how their voices are at the tables of policymakers and people who are making decisions. And so we had the Council of Pacific Arts meeting and the Culture Ministers meetings this week. And so SPC, we were quite deliberate about making sure that those Indigenous voices and the practitioners, cultural custodians, and the youth were at the same tables in dialogue with, you know, key policymakers, UNESCO, EU, a lot of the, you know, sort of big oceans agencies. So I think that, you know, the important thing about FestPAC is that it is that platform to bring those two groups together.
Very thoughtful.
I am very curious later on. I know Catherine, we were talking about this later, but because like this is the first time Hawaii hosted it, I was curious about how Hawaii policymakers will include more Indigenous voices in future discussions. But this festival was actually, they had a very large turnout. We know we anticipated more than 100,000 people to attend the festival. Aaron Salah actually said at yesterday's closing ceremony that by day two of FestPack, there was more than 100,000 people that attended the festival. And by the end of 10 days, there's actually more than 500,000.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to make an effort to go to as many as I could, you know, in other venues besides the convention center, and I wasn't disappointed.
I learned a lot during this festival, especially the different weaving styles and techniques of the festival. But now we know the next host is going to be in New Caledonia in 2028, and that's still underway.
All right, okay, and lots of unrest in that country still. But thank you so much, Cassie. That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio. She's been covering FestPack 2024 along with Kuven Hiraishi. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929, for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, host of The Body Show. Each week, we do our best to provide you with up-to-date medical information from our local experts that might help you or someone you love know more about the world of medicine. Join us today for our latest episode at 6:30 right here on The Body Show.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
FestPack 2024 was a rare opportunity to make connections. As one island leader put it, we are not people from small islands, but we are the guardians, the caretakers of the world's largest ocean. This was the first gathering for Niatero, a nonprofit group that got its start in the Amazon and is focused on branching out to indigenous peoples across the Pacific. Its name means our earth. And during the festival, Niatero co-hosts an event pre-screening a film about Rapa Nui's native peoples and its culture survival against all odds. At one point in time, less than 200 Native Islanders remained. You know, we invited Joseph Williams, Niatero Board Chairman, and Hawaii Board Member Aulani Wilhelm into our studios to talk about the organization's mission. You may know Wilhelm, who previously worked with NOAA's Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, as well as Conservation International. Wilhelm says Niatero was seated at Conservation International and explains why its work is so important.
Really, it's about caring for that which feeds our aina, right? Land and sea. And coming from Hawaii, we really realized that there are more to taking care of places than bringing conventional systems of science and policy together. Really at the heart of it, the best of what's left on the planet, science confirms, is in the hands of indigenous peoples and those who are closest to the land and sea. So where there is still diversity on the planet, it's no surprise that there's also cultural diversity and richness of that. And that tie between nature and the abundance and quality of nature is correlated directly to the diversity and abundance of culture. And that's why coming together and talking about this while we're here at FestPack, seeing people from all around the Pacific here, is really reflected in all the songs, in the stories, the dances, and actually all of the comments that we heard at the opening session. It was so inspiring to hear people from all around the Pacific saying really very much the same things, to make sure that our earth is healthy so that people can be healthy, it's really important that we protect our culture.
I'm from the other end of the Polynesian Triangle, from Aotearoa, and the same issues arise, of course. The word we use for the ocean, the ancestors we relate to, the spiritual deities that relate to the ocean, they're all the same as the ones here. You guys speak a language that if you speak it slowly enough, I can follow it. Except it sounds like you guys have got a really bad lisp. So that story about one ocean is not just physically and scientifically true, it's culturally true, it's genetically true. And underlying that are the same attitudes of reverence for ocean, for our relations that swim in the ocean, for the relationship of mutual obligation between us, those species, if you want to use the modern word. These are common throughout the Pacific, and they contain this deep truth about how we should be and act when we are living in this vast spiritual realm called, we call it the Moananuiakiwa, the Great Ocean of Kiwa. So things like Festpack are most effective in reminding us that we are all really one, and trying to remind other people to whom our relationships are more distant, who moved into these places in an unsuccessful attempt, thankfully, to displace we who are already there, that our ways of relating to land and ocean and the things within those places make sense.
Well, you know, I was very intrigued. I stopped by the Taiwan Hale at the convention center at the village, and I did not know the history of how the Han Chinese took over Taiwan and the indigenous people there. So it opened my eyes to, you know, some of that connection that we have throughout the Pacific. I guess really it's that going to the core, right? The culture of these islands, of these islanders, and how they've endured over time with empires from other places in the world trying to take over. And that's what this organization is all about, right?
It is. And what's beautiful about it in the Pacific is hard, and the struggles that all of our peoples have actually sustained through a very short history, more recent history, it's really holding on to the joy and holding on to the togetherness and holding on to the beauty of our places and the wisdom of our ancestors, instead of, you know, saying this is the tragedy that we've endured and just kind of sitting in that. It's saying we are still here. In fact, many people you would have heard, right, at the opening saying, yes, all these things have happened to us, but we are still here. We are strong. We have a strong foundation, and we will persist. And so the work we're doing at Niatero is really about supporting Indigenous communities to do what they need to be able to remain in their homelands, to be able to be active guardians, caretakers of the land and sea and each other. Right? That reciprocal relationship that Joe just spoke about, that kinship, that's really when you're holding, you should say this when I was at Popohonamokuakea, when people say, well, you know, you're the manager of, I was like, actually, when you're a descendant of these coral reefs that are our oldest living ancestors, non-human ancestors, we're not managers of these places. Our responsibility is completely different, because this is about our ancestry. This is about taking care of our cousins, our grandparents, our parents. And the risk isn't that biodiversity loss will occur, that there will be less fish in the sea. It's that our heritage and our responsibility to take care of our ancestors for future generations are at risk. So that's a holding it is a really different way of thinking about why we need to care for these places. And in the face of climate change, when islands, and we heard about this all through the week, islands are already going away. So what does that say? When our islands go away, do we as islanders, are we erased? Right, and a wonderful thing, you must be very proud to see how many Chamorro and the big representation from Guam and all of the other islands in the Western and Central Pacific, often referred to as Micronesia, right? Who the strength, and look at what these islands, your islands, have endured over just really the last couple of hundred years.
Yeah, and someone at the Hale was telling me, because I happened to see, he was a blacksmith and he had a machete and all the different things that the Chamorros created, thanks to the Spanish, right? We got the metal off the ships and all of that. But he just said, you know, we're really resourceful. Mm. We're resourceful people. And we have managed to survive given all these external forces and powers. But, you know,
with climate change, it's more important now than ever to really empower the people.
Yes. Climate change is a symptom, not a cause. This is the great distinction between, to use the cliche, the way of the colonizer as against the way of the colonized. And at Neotero, we use this term guardianship, ocean guardianship, ocean kinship, land guardianship. We spend all of our energy, all of the resources we can get from rich people to be able to transfer to Indigenous peoples to assist them to perform their obligations of guardianship in their territories, their oceans, and their lands. We use that word as a very inaccurate word, as good as the English language is going to get, for this idea that people who belong to place are descendants of place. And the sharp distinction is this. In the cultures and legal systems that came from Europe and spread across the world in those fateful two or three centuries, they expressed their relationship with the planet using a term that we're all familiar with now called property. So the planet and its resources were either property or they were commons. That was the nature of the relationship. Either someone owned it or it was anybody's with no obligations. In fact, either way, there were rights and no obligations. So at its core, the legal system and the culture that is brought to these places during the colonial period was utterly extractive because you didn't have a relationship with that place. You owned it. It was a commodity. Or you didn't have a relationship with that place because no one has a relationship with that place. It's anybody's. You could use it up, throw it away. First up, best dressed. And that's the state of the oceans. It is that system that creates climate change. What Neotero is trying to do by shifting the idea, the focus from rights, from ownership, from property to guardianship and kinship and obligations is to break that cycle, to have Indigenous peoples teach those who brought these Enlightenment ideas from Europe that there's something wrong with the way they relate to the planet.
So it's a real paradigm shift.
That's right. And it is as deep can get. We kind of forget that everything is culture, right? When people say, I own that land, that is a cultural statement. And they can say that because the culture from which that system comes says, I am the master of that place. I can use it up and throw it away, or I can sit on it and leave it and do nothing with it. I am its master, and I am God. This is the ultimate kind of the end point of this logic is I am master of the planet. I am God, or at least in Christian belief, I am God's intermediary. And in Indigenous beliefs, that is utter bullshit. And the things that the projects that Neotero engages in are time after time attempts to amplify the voices of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous cultures who are saying, that is bullshit and you need to change or we all die.
That was part of a conversation we had with Joe Williams and Olani Wilhelm, who are with a group called Neotero, which translates to Our Earth. The group's here to begin a dialogue with Indigenous peoples about our responsibility to take better care of our oceans and our land. We will have more on this right after a break.
It was the most widespread miscarriage of justice in UK history.
Hundreds of post office workers in the UK were prosecuted under mysterious circumstances and largely ignored until a TV show ignited a fire.
I don't think you can point to a single television drama which has had such a huge impact, both in terms of public anger and then political movement.
It's on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dean Slider, author of Fear Less. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to live beyond fear anxiety, anger, and addiction.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Let's get back to our conversation with Nia Taro. We were hearing from Board Chair Joseph Williams, who has served as Chief Justice on New Zealand's High Court. He and Hawaii's Aulani Wilhelm were talking about a call to action over issues like climate change, which threaten communities across the globe.
I'm putting on my pragmatic hat. So how do you make this happen? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this organization didn't exist the last time we held FESPAC, correct? So this is kind of a new idea. That you're trying to get out to all the islands in the Pacific.
Well, the world, actually. Mm-hmm. The Pacific is one place. The cool thing about Nia Taro and why I suspect Aulani climbed on board and why I agreed to climb on board, eyes wide closed, was this idea that you could build an organization that is made of an identity crisis. It's neither Indigenous nor colonizer, nor non-Indigenous, right? It's neither Western nor Indigenous. It's the space between those two things. It sounds a little weird. It's the tension. It's the place where the sparks fly. It's the place where peace and understanding can be made. It is, in its structure, the conversation that we need to have between Indigenous and the non-Indigenous world.
And so you're reinserting that conversation throughout the Pacific to say the time is now.
We're starting to. We're pretty new still, and we work in other places like in the Amazon where our early work really began. And so we're having those conversations, and it's in that middle space, right? What's in our collective self-interest to come to that tension spot that Joe's talking about to really forge the necessary ways forward? And part of it is changing a little bit of the funding structure and the way that how are resources and assets deployed, right? Pushing up against development models or government models or philanthropic models that say, here's what we think needs to get done. Here are our funding parameters. What are you going to do within this funding parameter scope? And tell us how you've done it and report. That is well-intentioned and has done many good things. But to really get to meet the crisis that we're seeing in the world, we really have to change the ability of Indigenous peoples to self-determine what they need in order to be those guardians that Joe's talking about. And so that's about changing that framework of what partnership means. How is it based on trust, on principles where we agree upon that we are that middle space, that we actually need the best of all solutions? The world's in a bit of a hurt right now. So, and if we know that the only proven solution to really caring for the health of the planet, had the time-tested solution has been Indigenous guardianship, wherever that has been, the best of what's left on the planet now from ecosystems or biodiversity are in these places, then we need to build from those values and we need to bring everyone forward and along. And that means changing practical things like the way money flows.
So another way of putting what Aulani said is we're trying to decolonize philanthropy. Philanthropy, it seems to me, I haven't spent a lifetime in it, but having now spent a few years in it, philanthropy is a top-down game of master and servant in which he who has the money calls the shots. And that doesn't work.
So you're trying to reclaim the power to spend that money so that the Indigenous peoples can say, we need it here.
Well, if we're serious about saying, can you teach us your ways, we sure as hell shouldn't be controlling how they decide to do that. I mean, we're the recipients. We're getting the advantages here. We're asking them to teach us. We better not control how they spend the resources that we provide for them to teach us. And we're not by us, I mean the rest of humanity. Because in assisting Indigenous peoples to exercise guardianship over their territories, they're helping us to understand how all territories, the entire planet, ought properly to have guardianship over it.
Any final thoughts?
So the Pacific is one area that we're really continuing to scope and see, hey, where are those partners that we share these common set of ideas about? But we're also looking at really what needs to happen in oceans. The Pacific is obviously the largest ocean on the planet. We still have cultures all around that are evident here at FESPAC and people that are still very much directly dependent and connected and based on cultural practices from a long time, still in action, right? So how can our communities here in the Pacific help us guide? How do we address some of these hard-hitting issues in the ocean using this framework, using these values of how we hold the planet, and how can that guide us forward? And we're looking in other areas of that we're not yet invested in globally, in considering Africa, considering Asia, and also aside from the tools of really bringing finance and funding forward, are there other ways that we can, through different kinds of funding models or through technology or other ways, that we can support threats or help Indigenous people fight against the threats that are really pushing up still every day, whether it's logging or mining or whatever extractive use is, as Joe's talking about? How can those common issues be addressed at scale?
We're active in the places where Indigenous guardianship has already ensured that biodiversity and the retention of forest cover and so on has occurred. So the bits that are left are all subject to Indigenous guardianship in some way. In fact, whether they are as a matter of law is entirely beside the point. The fact of the matter is the places where there are bits left are all places of Indigenous people. And that's not an accident. It's because they're places of Indigenous people that those bits are left. So our focus has been that. We need to expand into Africa and Asia to do the same thing. We need to be much more effective in the Pacific. The Pacific is the world's largest carbon sink and the world's largest heat reducer. And it's our backyard. And we have ways of relating to this place that can help it do what it needs to do in a way that supports everybody.
That which supports everybody. A call to action to find solutions in a different way of looking at the problem and the symptoms. That was Joseph Williams and Aulani Wilhelm, who are with the group Neotero, which translates to Our Earth. We'd like to think it was one of the many thoughtful conversations that came out of FESPAC 2024. The work of Japanese textile artist Akihiko Izukura is being featured here in the islands. A pop-up exhibit in Trunk Show is underway at the Fish Cake Gallery here in Honolulu. You may be familiar with Izukura's work that some regard as a silk master. His large-scale installations of silk tunnels and cocoon spheres have been showcased on Maui, Oahu, and the island of Hawaii. Izukura planned to return to the islands, but COVID delayed his plans, and he passed away last year. His final body of work is highlighted in a documentary entitled Inundo, Circles of Motion, that screened on Oahu this past weekend. The conversation's Lillian Song sat down with Kyoto filmmaker Kazuki Fujimoto and Mika Ichikawa of Remnant & Company, which aims to perpetuate his legacy.
As an entrepreneur, to keep the family business going with the more than 300 employees, that was tough. At the same time, he is an artist. So he wants to express his creation, wants to show his creation as well. And also, he is a philosopher. He has his own way of thinking. He was actually more than 50 years ahead of time, showing us the sustainable, now the catchy word everywhere. Mm-hmm. His philosophy of zero waste. Mm-hmm.
How did he connect with nature?
He was in a kind of mass product industry, so he was doubting because there are some waste that mm-hmm. his employees had to throw away. Mm-hmm. And then he found that you shouldn't throw. This is also silk. It's the mm-hmm. same material.
He actually quit using the things that dyes. Quite oddly. Now people started using natural dyes for their own sake.
Okay, so how did he turn this waste into something that the public could consume? Mm-hmm. What sort of products then did this waste turn into?
In the process of making threads, we have the kuzumayu, which is the rejected parts of the cocoon thread. But he loves it. So it's actually hard and difficult to make those uneven fibers into thread. But he took painstaking process to make the thread out of it.
Okay, so just backtracking. This was the kuzumayu was like from the cocoon. So what you're saying, as a weaver, you want very uniform threads.
Right.
Weft and
warp and,
everything. But now with the kuzumayu, it's irregular. It's
irregular.
Like, because it's part of the cocoon. It's like very uneven.
Right.
But he saw the beauty in it.
Right.
And so with this, celebrating the irregularity, celebrating the naturalness, and then incorporating it into his designs, into his fabric.
Right. And also talking about the textile and designing into the garment, we try not to make the waste cut apart to throw it away. So maybe you can think of the origami.
Because origami, you're starting off with a square,
right,
flat piece.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to cut out from it because you don't want to create any waste. You're going to utilize this big 2x2 square in your design.
Right. So that we fold it down to create the pocket.
Okay.
Or
you just make a slit. I'm looking at Minka's beautiful light jacket she has on. What is the name of this piece?
It's origami haori.
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 Haori is like
the robe. Yeah, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I can see too, instead of like making sleeves, you've got folds and then you have slits for the arms to come out. But the way the designer has stitched it together, it falls very nicely to give you the shape of sleeves. Mm-hmm. And as you're walking, it flows so beautifully in the wind, the movement. So I think capturing his ethos of nature, bringing it into. So this is a piece of clothing that has his fingerprints all over it. Mm-hmm. But going back to his exhibits, his artwork, going back to that video of just this on campus at UH Manoa, it was this big tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
The video was so just amazing because as the wind's blowing, you're seeing in this tunnel, the walls just flowing in and out with the wind. You're hearing the birds in the background and the colors. You've got that beautiful pink. It blended into browns and all natural, but scale-wise, how large was that piece?
60 meter high, and 60 meter long. Right. That biggest one.
That's the biggest one. Mm. Yeah,
that but was a really large piece.
The in Hawaii one is 20 meter.
20 meter.
The Big Island one.
Big Island.
Because I know he went back in 2014, and there was another similar exhibit on the Big Island. Okay, why is it important to share the legacy of Izukura Sensei?
Someone told me that his work, especially the giant silk souffle, dyed with the natural colors, everyone get happy to see it.
Right.
Yeah.
Feel the lives of silkworms.
And no one get annoyed. I mean, you know, the art can be, you know, harsh sometimes. It's not always gentle with human soul. But his work, his textile, and his garment is just a gentle on everyone's soul. Just touch the pure silk fiber and you feel kind of melt, you know? I really enjoy watching people enjoy touching his work. I mean, you're more than welcome to touch his work and also the garment, and also enjoy wearing and feeling much better. Yeah, that's what I love about what we do as a remnant.
When I was in Canada, 2010 to 2014, I was a mountain hiking guide. Canada was very successful to coexist, you know, between wildlife and human lives. So when I came back and I saw Japan, what we do in terms of like caring nature or caring wildlife, then I met Izukura-san, and he was growing silkworms to get the precious thread, silk thread, to make clothing or textile that, you know, support human beings. So I was so impressed listening to his philosophy as well as actual art pieces. I was so fascinated and impressed. So I can see how much he cares or he wanted to coexist mm-hmm. with natural creatures or natural environment. Mm-hmm. As many people say, environment is very important for us to sustain our lives. I really would like people to feel through seeing his art pieces that we are one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just I would like people to feel the kindness or gentleness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, to the environment or
to yourself.
To yourself. You to yourself as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're part of it.
Right.
Well, Mika, you know, you're continuing the legacy.
We are already talking about coming back. So we'd like to show people more work and also wants to have more workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that we can meet more people and let people know about the Izugrasan's work and let people know what we are doing and connecting people and make this kind of, you know, our tiny movement a little bit bigger, little by little.
That was HPR's Lillian Song talking with Mika Ichikawa and Akazuki Fujimoto, who are dedicated to preserving and sharing the work of Japan's famed textile artist Akihiko Izukura. Another documentary film about continuing to share Izukura's philosophy is in the works. Remnant in Company's Trunk Show featuring Izukura's textiles runs through July 20th at Fishcake.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
Next time on The World, a musician born in Mumbai, India, brings her own spin on classic American folk tunes.
I don't see any difference between when I sing Wayfaring Stranger or a Bilawal Raga from India.
Her band, the American Patchwork Quartet, is taking the stage at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. Catch that story on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Hawaii's Marcus Mariota is entering his 10th season in the NFL. He grew up on Oahu and played quarterback at St. Louis School. Mariota was originally drafted second overall by the Tennessee Titans in 2015. After spending 5 seasons there, he spent time with the Las Vegas Raiders, Atlanta Falcons, and Philadelphia Eagles. Earlier this year, he signed a contract with the Washington Commanders. The conversation's Russell Subiano happened to be in D.C. while the Commanders were holding practice there. He got the opportunity to catch up with Mariota at their training facility.
Those are some of the practice sounds that I heard as I was walking into the Washington Commanders training complex. I wasn't allowed to get close to the practice field. Practices are closed to the media. But I was able to watch them from a distance as I waited near the players' entrance into the facility. It wasn't long before practice ended and players began walking past me to get into the building. As a sports fan, it was a little surreal to watch these professional athletes walk by me, many that I've seen play on TV. And it wasn't long before Marcus arrived.
appreciate you taking the time.
No worries. All right, you want to sit down? You can sit down.
Yeah. If I could angle away from
the... Oh, then we can come up.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Right.
It was early June, and it was hot. Not suffocating hot, but hot enough. And Marcus had just finished hours of practice outdoors, and the last thing I wanted to do was ask him to stand in the heat more. So we found a nearby tree with some shade and the sounds of heavy equipment operators tearing up an old turf practice field in the distance.
I know that a lot of fans are excited about everything that's new, right? New owner, new coach, new coaching staff, a revamped roster. What kind of attracted you to come to be part of the team this year?
It really started with Coach Quinn. I think when we were on the phone, and just the culture aspect that he wanted to bring here, it was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. You know, it was fun to, you know, talk with Brian. Brian and I have a previous relationship from Philly, and I think very highly of him. So for me to be a part of this, I thought was just a great opportunity.
Do other factors like being able to compete to be the starter or to have a leadership role with the team, does that also kind of factor into your decision?
Yeah, there's a multitude of factors that probably play into it. You know, but for me, I really just wanted to be around good people. You know, I'm getting older, and, you know, winning for me is important, but being able to enjoy your job and come to work and make a difference, those are things that are really kind of stand out for me. So that in itself was probably more the reason why I decided to come this way, and I'm just excited to be a part of this team.
One of the things that makes this season interesting for the Washington Commanders is the addition of rookie quarterback Jaden Daniels. Jaden and Marcus's entry into the NFL mirror each other. Both were Heisman Trophy winners their final year in college. Both were drafted number 2 overall. And both were taken by teams in need of revitalization at the quarterback position.
I'm sure people have pointed out the similarities between your rookie year and Jaden's rookie year this year. Was there anything that you learned your rookie year that you're bringing to the QB room this year that, you know, maybe you wish had gone a little bit differently for you?
Yeah, you know, I think in one of the first meetings we had talked as a quarterback group, I was just like, I was very adamant that, you know, you don't have to be perfect. When I came in as a rookie, like, I was trying to do everything the right way. I was trying to just be perfect on the field. And at that, you can get very robotic and you don't really kind of play to your strengths. So I just told Jaden, man, like, you know, given the opportunity, just play your game. You've been playing this since you're a little kid, and, you know, just do what you do and, you know, learn. You'll experience some things and you'll learn from it, but there's no reason to try to be perfect.
But what I was really interested in was getting Marcus's thoughts on the rise of Polynesians and Hawaii-born players in the higher-profile so-called skill positions. In the past, Samoans, Hawaiians, Tongans, and other Polynesians were typically relegated to football positions that emphasized power and strength and a massive physique. But in recent years, we've seen Polynesians excel at positions that relied more on speed and broader strategic decision-making, like quarterback and wide receiver. Players like Miami Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa.
Tua, 3rd and 6. He's 12 of 16. Land the block. Go! He's got him! He's got him! And they've got a touchdown!
And Los Angeles Rams receiver Puka Nacua, who was a candidate for Rookie of the Year last year.
Stafford. Lofting, end zone, Nacua, he's got it! Touchdown, Rams!
Legend of Puka just continues to grow.
So what were his thoughts? And how much of a difference does it make when there's other Polynesians in the locker room?
Yeah, I think it really started, gosh, long before I was, you know, even coming out. Coach Vinny Passas did a great job at St. Louis of incorporating 7-on-7, throwing routes. You know, he called him his get better camps on the weekends. And I really believe that kind of was the bloodline for a lot of other players to play different positions. Like, I think there was such a stereotype of Polynesian players playing linebacker or playing offense and defensive line. But what Coach Vinny did, he was able to kind of change the norm and allow guys to kind of see a future in different positions. So I really believe that he deserves a lot of the credit for really a lot of these players that are playing at different spots.
Is it exciting to come to this team and there are Polynesian players here? I know Benning's on the roster, Frankie Luvu, Tavita Pritchard, your QB coach. Is that exciting for you?
Absolutely. There's an immediate connection, right? You know, it's nice to be able to have that. And it, you know, we were all kind of raised the same way. Mm-hmm. And to be able just to kind of enjoy each other's company and to kind of be here together and to try to change a team, change a culture, it's been really fun. And I'm very appreciative of those guys because, you know, the relationships that you build are lifelong. They last forever. You know, football is such a short period of your life. But to be able to enjoy these moments with people that have been raised the same way you are, I think is really cool.
What kind of advice would you give to Polynesian or Hawaii-born players or athletes that aspire to compete at a professional level?
Oh, dream big. Dream big. I really believe, you know, the sky's the limit. And there's no reason to just aspire just to go to your local high school. I think, you know, there's so many guys across the league. There's so many guys across the country in the collegiate level that you can be whoever you want to be. And, you know, when that moment comes and you get that opportunity to live out your dream, just remember to go home and make a difference. You know, that's what's most important, is being able to help the next generation.
And have you learned anything in your professional football playing career that you don't think you would have learned had you had another career?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think, like, the amount of different relationships with people, you know, for me, I probably would have been somewhere on the West Coast or back home in Hawaii, and I would have never met people that are from Florida, you know, that are from, you know, other parts of the country, and to kind of learn how they were raised and how, you know, their kind of culture is. You know, I think that's what's been really cool for me in my 10th season is I've just met so many different players and so many people. And to be able to develop those relationships and learn a little bit about people, learn where they come from, how they live, you know, what they do, what, you know, what kind of food they eat. You know, I think it's just like those little things you can't necessarily get, you know, doing a regular 9-to-5 job.
At that point, I could feel my time winding down, and I didn't want to be the thing standing between Marcus and any post-practice obligations or a shower. But before wrapping up my time with Marcus, I had one last question. For context, back in January 2018, while playing for the Tennessee Titans in a game against the Kansas City Chiefs, Marcus threw a pass that was deflected into the air by a defensive player. Marcus was able to catch it and dive into the end zone for a touchdown.
Play, third down and goal. Tennessee in dire need of 6 and not 3. Mariota to the line of scrimmage, maybe across the line. It deflects back to him for a touchdown for the moment.
He essentially caught his own pass for a touchdown.
Cool. And this is my last question. It's actually from my son. He asked me to ask you, do you plan to teach Jaden how to catch his own deflected pass and score a touchdown?
that's a great question. I think it's funny, right? Like, those things just kind of happen. And I'm sure Jaden, through his career, will have moments where he's going to do something kind of unreal. I'm sure he's ready for those moments. But yeah, man, you never know when they're going to come.
Awesome. Marcus Mariota, thanks so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That was Oahu-born NFL quarterback Marcus Mariota talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Mariota is entering his 10th NFL season this year, his first with the Washington Commanders. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about the medical needs of West Hawaii. We recently highlighted the expansion plans of Hilo Medical Center. What does the Kona side need to be there for the growing community? We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.